4:30 Eastern Wartime, your station, WEAF, New York.
This is Don Hollenbeck in the NBC newsroom in New York. First, two late bulletins from London. The German High Command says tonight that great enemy formations appeared at the coast of northern France between Calais and Dunkirk this morning. The great struggle on the northern coast of France has begun, a Nazi broadcast quotes the High Command. If true, this is a threatened landing on a new point of the French coast. The German DNB news agency reports tonight that Marshal Karl von Rundstedt and Marshal Erwin Rommel, Nazi commanders in Western Europe, are on the spot of the developments. Reports on invasion are pouring in, mostly from the enemy in recent minutes, and the enemy is busy making admissions. Admissions that our troops are pouring ashore at many places along the Normandy coast. A German broadcast says Allied parachutists have now taken over an airfield in the Boulogne-Calais area, along the Dover Strait. That, of course, would be in an entirely new section of the French coast, more than 50 miles up from the earlier announced invasion area, which stretches all the way from Le Havre to Cherbourg. This new German report places the Allies in action directly across the strait from the cliffs of Dover, which, if true, would mean that the invasion is spreading out over a wide area. This unconfirmed news from the enemy says our parachute troops not only have occupied an aerodrome in the Calais area, but they have gained what is termed a foothold in that general area. Shortly before this report, NBC monitors here heard Berlin radio tell of a fierce naval engagement between Calais and Dunkirk. The British radio says that the Allied invasion line in France is now sufficiently broad to amount to more than just a beachhead. Of course, we know that additional landings are on the schedule, and from the flow of statements from the Germans, these landings are being carried out. Vichy radio has been heard saying that 200 Allied ships had been sighted off the coast above Cannes, there where more men naturally would be expected to go ashore to reinforce those already landed and pushing inland. Vichy radio admits that the Allied beachhead area has been considerably widened and that those fresh troops are leaving landing craft. Fierce fighting is taking place in the islands of Guernsey and Jersey, which lie west of the Norman Peninsula. This is another enemy report. Another German broadcast speaks of new Allied landings in the area of Carentan, just opposite the island of Jersey. I must point out here that all these reports are emanating from the Germans, and of course must be regarded with great caution. From our own sources, the latest is more or less of a general nature. General Montgomery, commanding the armies invading France, who sent his men into battle with the message bespeaking great confidence and ending traditionally with the Montgomery send-off, good luck and good hunting. Montgomery says he's pleased with the initial phase of the operations. In Washington, Admiral Ernest King said after a conference with President Roosevelt that the invasion is doing all right so far. And here's another German report. Allied troops are said to have won full possession of the town of Honfleur at the mouth of the Seine River. Honfleur is just across the river mouth from Le Havre. The German propaganda agency, in a late summary, says that the Allied forces hold the coast for 15 miles between Villers and Trouville, which is to the south, across the Seine estuary from Le Havre. Prime Minister Churchill earlier told Commons that our soldiers have penetrated France in some cases several miles inland and that the first phases have been thoroughly satisfactory with losses far less than was expected. The Prime Minister told us that our airborne landings, the landing of the troops who bore the first brunt of battle, was an outstanding feat on a scale far larger than anything there has been so far in the world. The German report on this is at least four divisions of American parachute and airborne troops alone had been landed on the Normandy Peninsula. These troops from the sky created a major diversion, many demolitions. War-painted American Indians were among the first of these paratroops to land in France this morning. These Indians are a troop picturesquely self-termed the Filthy 13. They're well-trained demolition engineers, packing 180 pounds of equipment on their lean, hard bodies. As you no doubt have noted, any newscast at this time is well sprinkled with bulletins. That's how fast things are developing, and here's another one. 15 Allied cruisers and 50 to 60 destroyers are reported by the Nazi DNB agency to be operating west of Le Havre tonight. That's another enemy report. Every plane taking the troops this morning through the purple, cloudy skies of the dawn was painted with broad zebra stripes, blue and white stripes, and the planes carried colored lights. All this was to prevent a repetition of that Sicilian episode in which a number of our own transports were accidentally shot down by their own ack-ack fire. That brightly lighted armada, traveling only a few hundred feet above ground, stretched out, we're told, for 200 miles. Immediately following this broadcast at 4:45, NBC will broadcast at dictation speed the text of the prayer which President Roosevelt has asked the nation to repeat with him at 10 p.m. Eastern wartime. The prayer is about 500 words long. If you haven't been able to get the text of it, this will be a good opportunity for you to copy it down in time to repeat it with the president tonight. The prayer will be given at dictation speed, 4:45 Eastern wartime, immediately following this broadcast. The invasion, incidentally, was scheduled for yesterday, but was delayed because of the weather. The invasion overshadowed developments on other war fronts, but activity continues on these fronts. Russian armies are understood to be massing for blows against the Germans from the east. In Italy, remnants of the German army are fleeing in disorder toward some new sort of defense line in the northern mountains. The Fifth Army is pouring after the enemy across the Tiber River in many places. Allied communiques say the battle to destroy the enemy continues without pause. And as a footnote to this assault from the west, the south, and soon from the east, Premier Pietro Badoglio announces in Naples that he has dissolved his Italian government, is forming a new administration in liberated Rome. One more bulletin from Washington this time. Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson has just told newsmen that first reports of the Allied landings in France indicated the long-awaited invasion was going very nicely. And here's a story overheard by our NBC monitors. The Nazis are suppressing news of the progress of the invasion and withholding the facts from the German people. Radio Atlantic, the German secret transmitter, says in a broadcast monitored this afternoon by NBC, "What scant news that is put out by the German home radio is very confused and depressing. The people of Berlin have gathered in the streets in whispering knots, wondering where the next blow will fall. They know that nightfall and the hours of darkness now ensuing will mean more landings. Their prime question is, where?" The clandestine transmitter, located somewhere in Germany, often has accurate reports of what's going inside the country. It's significant, the anti-Nazi radio points out, that though broadcasts beamed to Germany from England repeat the German claims of successes in naval engagements in the Channel, the Reich home radio has made no such statements. In all the volumes of bulletins, communiques, announcements, and stories of the invasion today, one great factor hasn't been mentioned. It may be that it's too early to get any reports. That factor is the French underground, the silent, secret army of patriots that has dared so much awaiting this day and which should at this very moment have flamed into action all over France. For days now, General Eisenhower's headquarters has been broadcasting instructions to this underground army, orders as definite and as important as any issued to the Allied troops waiting in England. Just today, General de Gaulle sent them orders from London. He declared that the Allied landings opened France's battle for liberation. Our NBC monitors heard de Gaulle urging Frenchmen to carry on the war behind the enemy's lines, to coordinate their work closely with the frontal attacks by the main Allied armies. And here in the NBC newsroom a few moments ago, we just heard Radio Brazzaville, the free French radio in the Congo, broadcasting that the people of France, following the instructions of the Allied High Command, are prepared to take up arms in back of the German lines as one man. Vive la liberté, long live the United Nations, said Brazzaville. And that's France's reply to the orders of the Allied commanders. So far as we can learn now, no French fighting divisions have yet got into action. It may be, too, that this hasn't been announced, but we may be sure that French troops will be in the van of the March on Paris. Just now, it's up to that hidden army in France to strike where and how it can at the enemy, to follow the orders of their leader de Gaulle and of the Supreme Commander Eisenhower. I know something about this French underground army. In Algiers last winter, I used to meet some of its members who were reporting there for instructions, leaving France at great risk, using false names, crossing the Mediterranean, or sneaking through Spain any way they could, getting their orders and then going back at even greater risk. My French has a good deal of Nebraska about it, but I was able to get the idea of what this underground army was doing, just how important it was to the Allied cause. And I learned enough to wonder sometimes if people at home appreciated that. More? If even the Allied leaders appreciated what these underground patriots were up against. It's one thing to be a soldier with the dignity of a soldier and the assurance that goes with the proud wearing of the uniform, to carry weapons, to march and sail and fly under one's own flag proudly displayed. It's another thing to be a soldier in the dead of night, in the rags and tatters of a charcoal burner in the forest of Compiègne or on the docks of Marseille. He must move silently and swiftly. He must know how to dissemble. He must be able to keep his patriotism, his love of his country under control. He must pretend to bow to the enemy and to his own countrymen who have chosen to side with the enemy. These men we used to see in Algiers had drawn tight, old looks about their faces. Even in that bit of liberated France, they were never quite sure whom they could trust, and they did well to be wary. for Algiers and Constantine and Tunis and the other cities of North Africa were full of the enemy. We switch you now to Washington for a special broadcast, the President's News Conference. Now to Washington.
Start it there.
That's on the air.
This is Morgan Beatty in the White House in Washington. A few moments ago, the President held his first post-invasion press radio conference. President Roosevelt said that as of 12 o'clock today, American naval losses were 2 destroyers and 1 LST, that's landing ship tank. Losses relative to air landings were light, about 1%. He didn't say whether this meant personnel or ships involved. There were 181 reporters at the President's conference. Mr. Roosevelt said he felt the invasion was up to schedule, and, as Prime Minister Churchill would say, that is a mouthful. The President said that very few people here in Washington knew the timing of D-Day. You know, Mr. Roosevelt was alone among the high command, the only one that had stayed up most of last night to follow the voluminous reports of invasion. He studied each dispatch behind the White House blackout blinds. They were pulled down, apparently, to avoid even the rumors that a light in the White House at midnight last night might have started something. So when the chief executive faced the Washington press corps this afternoon, he was well abreast of the latest developments, but he gave us only an inkling of what these developments were, and anybody who asked any questions about them that he didn't think was proper, he promptly labeled improper. He said, however, that he was very happy, and all the anonymous and silent people around him, he meant the White House staff that he works with every day, were all smiles today. He said he had little war news, but it was all right to cover the part about the losses. He said, as a matter of fact, that we newsmen were getting things as fast as people in the White House. The invasion was definitely up to schedule. When he was asked about how closely held was the secret of invasion, he said he didn't know. He said many people here in Washington and elsewhere knew that we were sending large forces over to the other side, but you could almost number the people on your fingers of your hand who on this side knew exactly when the date was going to be. The president was asked about when this date was set. What did he know about it in advance? And he said that he knew that the date would be approximately in May or in early June. As a matter of fact, he added, I knew last night as the boats loaded and started across. The date was chosen very largely, according to the president, because of the roughness of the English Channel. The weather factor was very important. He said that we needed what seamen call small boat weather to get people on the beaches in small boats. And then he was asked again if that was a major factor on the choice of the date, and he said definitely it was. Some of the reporters wanted to know whether the invasion across the channel was timed to gear up with the fall of Rome. You know, Rome only fell yesterday. No, he said, because we didn't know when Rome would fall. But he did say that you can now see why we did not institute a second front when the politicians and others started clamoring for it. Said we started planning for this thing, producing the arms in December of 1941, and today's action, or last night's, was the culmination of all that planning. He said that, obviously, the last 6 months gave us a tremendous chance to bring in many more divisions and landing craft. He was asked about the Paris radio, saying he was going to London the last of June, and he wanted to know if that was the summer or the spring. That was his way of evading an answer. And here's a very important point he made just before the closing. He said, the thing we should be warned against at this moment is overconfidence. It's dangerous to the war effort. He said the war isn't over by any means, and this operation itself isn't over by any means. This is Morgan Beatty. I'm returning you now to the newsroom in New York from the White House in Washington.
This is Don Hollenbeck in the NBC newsroom. A quick summary now of the events of the day. The Allied invasion is doing well. Secretary Stimson has just added his report to that news. Mostly German reports say that we've made new landings. Enemy is busy making admissions that our troops are pouring ashore at many places along the Normandy coast. The new German report places the Allies in action directly across the strait from the cliffs of Dover. That would mean the invasion is spreading out over a wide area. These are all enemy reports, unconfirmed by our sources, and should be taken with caution. Shortly before this report, we heard Berlin tell of a fierce naval engagement between Calais and Dunkirk. The British radio says the Allied invasion line is now sufficiently broad to amount to more than just a beachhead. Of course, we know that additional landings are on the schedule. From the flow of statements from the Germans, these landings are being carried out. This is Don Hollenbeck in the NBC newsroom, and that's all for now.